I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
There are moments in history when fear becomes an instrument of power, when suspicion itself is weaponized, and a nation begins to turn inwards, searching not for enemies abroad, but for traitors amongst its own. Such was the age of McCarthyism, a dark episode in mid-20th century America when the shadow of communism grew long enough to divide neighbours, ruin careers, and redefine the meaning of loyalty. Welcome to History Unpacked. If you enjoy the content, consider subscribing. We post every week and we welcome any feedback. We hope you enjoy today's episode. The story begins not with Senator Joseph McCarthy, but with the deep anxieties that followed the end of the Second World War. America had emerged victorious, yes, but not unscathed. Its soldiers had returned to a changed world. Europe lay in ruins, and from that devastation rose a new ideological foe, the Soviet Union. The wartime alliance of convenience between Washington and Moscow had already begun to decay by 1946. Winston Churchill called it an Iron Curtain, a line of division stretching across Europe. Behind it, the Soviets were consolidating power. Ahead of it, the West was scrambling to defend democracy's frontier. To many Americans, communism was not just a foreign ideology, it was a virus. Subtle, invasive, and profoundly un-American. It rejected God, property, and individual liberty. And soon the question arose, what if it had already taken root at home? The House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, had been founded in 1938, but it was after the war that its influence swelled. Its mission, to uncover subversion and communist infiltration within the United States. The stage was set for a national inquisition. The first great spectacle of the anti-communist crusade took place not in the halls of Congress, but in the movie studios of California. Hollywood, glamorous, influential, and filled with voices that reached millions, was the perfect target. In 1947, HUAC summoned directors, screenwriters, and actors to testify about alleged communist ties. Some cooperated, naming names in the hope of self-preservation. Others refused, invoking the First Amendment or simple moral courage. 10 of them, screenwriters and directors mostly, stood firm. They became known as the Hollywood 10. For their defiance, they were cited for contempt of Congress, fined, and imprisoned. Worse still, they were blacklisted, denied work, branded as traitors in an industry that thrived on reputation. To the public, this was theatre of the highest order. Newspapers covered it daily, and the phrase, "Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?" became a cultural refrain, a symbol of fear dressed up as justice. Even those who despised communism began to see the danger in this spectacle. The idea that a man could lose his livelihood merely for his beliefs, real or imagined, cut to the core of what Americans thought their nation stood for. Yet, few spoke out. Fear of guilt by association silenced many more than laws ever could. Then came the man whose name would define the age, Joseph Raymond McCarthy. Junior senator from Wisconsin, was a relatively obscure figure in the 1950s. A former Marine, loud and brash, he was looking for an issue to make himself known. The opportunity came in February 1950 at a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia. Holding up a piece of paper, McCarthy declared that he had in his hand a list of 205 known communists working in the State Department. The number would change repeatedly in the days that followed, 57, 81, 10, but the damage was done. The words had been spoken. The press descended. In that single gesture, McCarthy transformed himself from an unknown senator into the face of a national crusade. no one ever saw the list. Its contents were vague, its evidence non-existent. But in the feverish atmosphere of early Cold War America, that scarcely mattered. The Korean War had just begun, the Soviet Union had tested its first atomic bomb, and China had fallen to communism. The American public was frightened, and McCarthy gave that fear a name and a target. He was, in a sense, a master showman. He understood that modern politics was as much about performance as policy. Under bright television lights, he wielded accusations like a weapon, his voice rising, his finger jabbing through the smoke-filled air of hearing rooms. He claimed to expose lies, spies, saboteurs, and secret communists hidden in the highest offices of the Republic. And whether or not his accusations held merit, they captivated a nation hungry for reassurance that someone, anyone, was hunting the invisible enemy. McCarthy's influence grew rapidly. The Senate subcommittee he chaired became a stage for public spectacle and private destruction. Government employees, diplomats, professors, even librarians found themselves summoned to answer impossible questions. Careers were ruined not by proof, but by suspicion. The system worked by contagion. Accusation beget fear, fear beget silence, and silence was taken as guilt. Even those who sought to clear their names found themselves trapped in endless cycles of questioning. In this climate, loyalty became a kind of currency. To be American was not enough. One had to be demonstrably, vocally, unambiguously anti-communist. Any deviation, an old friendship, a liberal opinion, a signature on a petition from decades earlier could be fatal. The FBI, under J. Edgar Hoover, encouraged this culture of vigilance. Hoover believed subversion lurked in every union hall, university, and publishing house. He oversaw vast surveillance programs, infiltrating organizations, and monitoring suspected sympathizers. To be clear, there were Soviet spies in the United States. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, executed in 1953 for passing atomic secrets, was the most famous example. But McCarthyism was never about espionage in any meaningful sense. It was about ideological conformity, about narrowing the boundaries of what could be safely said, thought, or believed. Among McCarthy's victims were many who had spent their lives in public service. Owen Latimore, an Asia expert once consulted by President Roosevelt, was accused of being the top Russian espionage agent in America. The charge was ludicrous, yet it ruined his reputation and forced him into years of legal battles. School teachers lost their positions for refusing to sign loyalty oaths. College professors were dismissed for refusing to name colleagues. Writers and artists who had once flirted with socialist ideals in the 1930s, when the Depression made communism seem a reasonable alternative, were hounded into silence or exile. For journalists, the choice was particularly cruel. To criticize McCarthy risked being labeled a communist sympathizer. To remain silent was to betray their craft. And so, for a time, the nation held its breath. But demagogues, by their nature, overreach. McCarthy's downfall began not with political opposition, but with the television camera, the very instrument that had once magnified his power. In 1954, McCarthy turned his attention to the US Army, accusing it of harboring communists. The Army fought back, and the resulting Army-McCarthy hearings were broadcast live to millions. For the first time, the American public saw the senator unfiltered. His bluster, his bullying, his reckless disregard for truth, the illusion cracked. When McCarthy interrupted one witness too many, Army Counsel Joseph Welch uttered the words that would end the senator's reign. "Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?" The line hung in the air. It was in that instant as though the spell had broken. The hearings exposed McCarthy's tactics as cruel and baseless. Support evaporated almost overnight. In December 1954, the Senate voted to censure him, a rare and humiliating rebuke. His power, once immense, vanished as swiftly as it had appeared. McCarthy died just 3 years later in 1957 of alcoholism at the age of 48. his fall was quiet, almost forgotten, like a bad dream from which the nation was eager to awake. Yet McCarthyism did not end with McCarthy. Its legacy persisted in the structure it had built: blacklists, loyalty oaths, and a political culture of suspicion. Hollywood remained wary for decades. Some of those blacklisted never worked again. Universities continued to monitor the political leanings of their staff. The notion that dissent equaled disloyalty lingered long after the senator's death. The era also revealed something enduring and unsettling about the American psyche. Beneath the country's confident exterior lay a deep vulnerability, a fear that democracy could be undone from within. Communism, in that sense, was less a threat than a mirror, a reflection of the anxieties of a superpower suddenly aware of its own fragility. Writers and thinkers of the time wrestled with these themes in fiction and philosophy alike. Arthur Miller's 1953 play The Crucible, though set through in the Salem witch trials, was a quick, clear allegory for McCarthyism. In its paranoid villages, audiences saw themselves, accusing, confessing, and condemning in the name of moral purity. The lesson was plain: when fear governs truth, every society becomes capable of persecution. Others, like George Orwell, through writing from across the Atlantic, had already foreseen such dangers. His vision of totalitarianism in 1984 resonated deeply with Americans who watched their own government flirt with censorship and ideological control. Even popular culture absorbed the drama. In the following decades, the figures of the informant, the blacklist, and the witch hunt became recurring motifs in film and literature. McCarthyism became shorthand for any campaign of mass accusation driven more by fear than fact. It is tempting to dismiss McCarthyism as an aberration, a temporary madness born of the Cold War, but history suggests otherwise. The impulse to seek purity, to divide citizens into patriots and subversives, run deep into the American experience. From the Red Scare of 1919 to the cultural panics of later decades, the pattern repeats. External threat becomes internal suspicion, and the line between vigilance and persecution blurs. In that sense, McCarthy was less a creator than a symptom. He merely gave voice to fears that already existed, fears that thrived in the tension between liberty and security, freedom and control. It was also during this era that the power of television journalism truly emerged. Reporters such as Edward R. Murrow of CBS played a crucial part in challenging McCarthy's authority. In March 1954, Murrow aired a devastating broadcast titled See It Now, in which he methodically dismantled McCarthy's claims using the senator's own footage. Murrow's closing words remain amongst the most famous in American journalism: "We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law." The program marked a turning point in public perception and in the media's willingness to confront demagoguery. It demonstrated that truth, carefully and calmly presented, still could cut through hysteria. But for every Murrow, there were dozens who stayed silent. Newspapers that might have spoken out early chose instead to chase circulation figures. Studios and universities bowed to pressure rather than risk funding a reputation. The great tragedy of McCarthyism was not only the damage done by the senator himself, but the complicity of institutions that allowed fear to dictate their conscience. As one historian later observed, it was not McCarthy who blacklisted America, it was America that blacklisted itself. By the late 1950s, the fever had broken. Yet the experience left behind a lingering distrust of government, of the press, even of one's neighbour. The rhetoric of suspicion did not disappear, it merely changed its target. In later decades, it would re-emerge under new banners, from anti-Vietnam protests to cultural wars and beyond. What McCarthyism taught, perhaps above all, was how fragile the boundary between vigilance and vengeance can be. It revealed that the instruments of democracy, the hearing, the committee, the vote, could, in the wrong hands, become tools of repression as easily as tools of justice. In hindsight, the age of McCarthyism stands as a both cautionary tale and a historical mirror. Each generation, it seems, must confront its own version of the witch hunt, its own temptation to trade liberty for the illusion of security. The methods evolve. Today's accusations may travel through screens rather than subpoenas, but the psychology remains strikingly familiar. Fear still sells, outrage still mobilizes, and the line between vigilance and paranoia remains perilously thin.